Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here on the last day of January 2021. This past week, we finally had a little bit of cold weather and the first sunny day of the year here in Sitka. Temperatures got down into the low 20s and probably even the teens in some places around town, but the official low didn't drop below 20 as best I could tell. Winds were relatively light for an outflow event, which kept things a little bit more pleasant and was nice to get out and experience some sunny weather after the repeated storms that had been coming through and keeping things warm and wet, relatively speaking, over the prior 6 weeks or more. It was enough that some of the plants have started to emerge from their winter hibernation. There is still plenty of time this winter for cold snaps of extended duration and exceptionally cold temperatures to happen, in which case those plants would probably get killed back. I remember prior winters where a relatively warm early winter followed by some extended cold and windy weather later in the winter ended up killing back a lot of the salmon berries, especially at low elevations, and there wasn't much of a berry crop that year, but of course they did grow back. So hoping that is not what happens this year, although I did see an iNaturalist observation that somebody posted of a salmon berry here in Sitka on the causeway actually out, so one of the warmer locations in the wintertime here in town, that had the flower petals already starting to emerge, showing plenty of pink of those springtime flowers. If you're getting out and observing things, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one that I recorded and originally aired back in early 2019. I spoke with Hans Tevesen. He is a evolutionary biologist working on whales, especially the evolutionary history of whales, as well as the sense organs of whales. He was in town as part of the Scientists in Residence Fellowship at the Sitka Sound Science Center. We'll go ahead and join the conversation with me asking him to go over and explain the evolutionary history of whales as it's currently understood. You've done a lot of work over the years in a variety of different things, but in particular fossils, paleontology, I guess, with respect to the evolution of whales and their transition from land mammals to sea mammals. And so I'd be curious if maybe just hearing an overview of kind of the current state of understanding of this transition from land mammal to sea mammal.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. The early 90s, when I started to work in Pakistan, the oldest whales that were known were about 40 million years old, and they basically looked like whales do now. They were had a sleek body with no neck, and they actually did have tiny hind limbs, but you wouldn't see them from a distance. They had flippers and a fluke. So that's what we knew about fossil whales. We knew that they had somehow had to be derived from a land mammal. And we thought that that land mammal was probably carnivore, because whales are nowadays are carnivorous. So, but there were no transitions and transitional forms, and it would be hard to imagine one. If you think a land mammal changing into a whale, that's a really big step. And it turned out what people had done ever since the 1800s is look for fossils in places where fossil collectors live, which was mostly North America and Europe. But the place where the transition actually happened was Pakistan and India. And so I worked in Pakistan and India initially not at all to look for fossil whales, actually sort of the opposite, because I'd gotten money from National Geographic, $5,000, to study migrations. India, around 50 million years ago, the Indian subcontinent around 50 million years ago, crashed into Asia, and that eventually led to the formation of the Himalayas. So there was an ocean, a sea between India and Asia. And I thought it would be really cool to collect fossil groups from before and after the collision, because you'd see before the collision there'd be animals that had been isolated on the Indian continent for a long time, and then suddenly you would get this influx of Asian animals in the same area. Well, that was an abysmal failure because we didn't find anything. But much more excitingly, we found these early whales. And as you can imagine, whales are not very good for studying migrations because they swim. So that was totally not the objective of the project, but National Geographic was very happy with us because we found something much more exciting. And the first thing we found was actually in the year of the Gulf War. We were only allowed 6 days. They kicked us out of the country because they were worried about us. They were worried about our safety. But we found some parts of the ear, some fossil bones that were ear bones. And I realized that they were whale ear bones and that they did not look like modern whale ear bones. So that was kind of a big deal. It seems like there was suddenly was a transitional form. Of course, all I had was the ear. And then the next year, I'd blown all this money in my first field season. I only had $1,000 left, so I could take myself, but I had to go alone. I didn't have money to bring anybody else. And so then we actually had the big find. The Pakistani colleagues that I work with and I found this fossil whale called Ambulocetus. That means the walking whale. It's an animal that we named, actually. It didn't exist before. First thing that we found of it was a knee joint. So at that point, I knew it couldn't be a whale because no whales were known with knee joints. But as we started, kept on digging, it took 3 days to dig this thing up. We found a skull, and we realized that actually it was a whale. It was the first whale for which that had legs that it actually could walk with on land. So that was a big deal. And so since then, that was 1994 that was published. We've collected a lot more in Pakistan and in India. Other people have too. And we found all of these intermediates. So it now seems that whales are derived from an even-toed ungulate, an animal that's related to pigs and sheep and cows and camels and giraffes, except this even-toed ungulate was tiny. It was like a tiny deer. It looked like a tiny deer, a deer the size of a cat. That was the last really land animal. And then afterwards, they go into the water. The earliest whales, things that you would call whales, although they didn't look like whales at all, these earliest whales looked basically like wolves. But they were already aquatic. They spend a lot of time in the water from the rocks. We know that this water wasn't very deep. There were very shallow streams. So imagine a wolf-like animal that mostly gets its food by hunting around these streams, maybe fish or maybe animals that come to drink. That's about 50 million years ago. Then 49 million whales go into the nearshore marine. They sort of look like crocodiles. And then in the next 6-7 million years, you get whales that look like seals and sea lions and otters. And then at 40 million years ago, you get these forms that I mentioned earlier that really look like a modern whale, the sleek body, no neck, tiny little hind limbs, and forelimbs that look like a flipper, hind limbs that are this triangular fin, the fluke. And so then we've made that transition. And at that point, all these other forms go extinct. So there seems to be this early stage of experimentation with what body design are we going to go for. And eventually when they hit on this modern design, everybody else goes extinct and they've left the land forever. They don't have to come back to give birth or anything. They're now fully aquatic animals. And at that point, also, of course, they're good swimmers, so they can swim and go to all the other continents. Those types of whales have been found in Europe, in Africa, in North America, in South America, even in Antarctica. So then they're everywhere. These earlier forms are only found in Pakistan and India because they were not good swimmers.
Mm. So you mentioned, I think you mentioned that they were carnivorous, but ungulates. And I guess the ungulates I'm familiar with are all herbivores, I guess. So back in the day, there was ungulates that were also carnivorous. Is that kind of, or did they make a transition around that time?
They made a transition around that time. And that's what I'm now very interested in because I don't understand it very well. So the ungulates that you're thinking of are herbivorous. There are omnivorous ungulates, such as pigs.
Right, yeah.
But from the chemistry of the teeth, we actually know that the early ungulates that the whales are derived from, those are all herbivorous. I've looked at the wear facets on the teeth. So, you know, as teeth in the mouth process food, the teeth rub against each other, and from the way they rub against each other, that leaves tiny scratches on the teeth, tooth wear. And you can sort of figure out how the animal is chewing. And we now know that these ungulates that became whales, that are the ancestors of whales, were chewing in a different way from their relatives. So even though they were still herbivores, like deer, they are already processing their food in a sort of a weird way. And that weird way of processing the food is then transferred to the early whales that now use that way of feeding to eat meat. So I'm really trying to figure out what these earliest, even these earliest ungulates were eating. I know it's a plant food. I know that from the chemistry. I know they were processing it in a weird way, in a meat type way, but I don't know what they were eating. Hmm. And that's a difficult thing to figure out. But it's also very exciting. It also shows you that they must have been eating some plant food that sort of processes like meat does, that where you need cutting type actions of your teeth.
Hmm. Yeah. It's fascinating to think about all these diversity of marine the whales, and I guess so. It's both toothed and baleen whales that both came from this. There wasn't two separate events, but kind of the same thing, and then they diverged after going into the ocean.
Yeah, thanks for making that point. I should have said that. So toothed and baleen whales, the earliest ones, are about 38 million years old. So then you get the distinction between those two, and baleen only goes back 38 million years. So before that time, the common ancestors of those, that's the animals I'm talking about. So those animals all had teeth. But don't call them toothed whales because they're also the ancestors of baleen whales. Mm. And baleen whales, the earliest baleen whales actually had teeth. Some people think they had teeth and baleen. They were getting rid of their teeth slowly. And actually modern baleen whales, when they're embryos, they still have teeth. And then by the time they're born, the teeth are gone and the baleen is replacing it.
So the teeth just get absorbed back into, embryonic teeth, I guess, get absorbed back into the body.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, so I know that baleen is made out of keratin. I guess what's it, like claws and fingernails are kind of like similar, but I don't know, what's it coming from, I guess, in the mouth?
So these... And as embryos and as fetuses, these baleen whales develop teeth in their jaw, just like we develop our teeth in our jaw. They're fully formed. And when they're fully formed in the jaw, they erupt out. So the formation is before the eruption of teeth, right? Before they show up in your mouth. The baleen whales don't take it that far because they don't let those teeth erupt and they resorb them. So the teeth are then gone. And then there is sort of this thickened pad on the palate that grows these baleen plates. And as you said, baleen consists of keratin. It's basically, your fingernails is actually a pretty good model. Just like your fingernails, baleen keeps on growing and growing. We cut our fingernails, baleen wears as the baleen whale uses it. It wears against the tongue, it wears against its foods, but it's constantly made new in the jaw. It only comes from the upper jaw. And then the part that hangs down on the mouth wears off. So it's your fingernails is a good model.
And so I guess, I mean, at some point, the jaw just started producing keratin. Are there other animals that produce the keratin like that in the mouth? Because, I mean, I guess that's what I'm just like, where did that come from?
That's right.
Like
that seems really weird for a mammal.
Yeah.
Birds, of course, have beaks that are made of keratin. And actually, as you go all the way back, the first vertebrates are lampreys, and they actually have teeth that are made out of keratin.
Hmm.
They have these I don't know if you should call them teeth. They look like teeth, but it's these rasping. It looks like they have a grater in their mouth, like to grate Parmesan cheese, except that's not what they eat. And those things are made out of, those little pegs, teeth, are made out of keratin. So it's actually not so weird.
Oh, okay.
Birds have keratin in their mouth. Lampreys do. It's a very versatile organ, but mammals have not gone that route. Baleen whales have.
So is this one of those, I mean, you were talking a little bit about sort of the DNA, and there's a lot of DNA that you know, we might be carrying along that's ancestral from prior, you know, organisms that preceded us that is no longer sort of active or functioning in the way that it once was. Does having that sort of in the history tend to make it easier for it to show up again? I mean, is it, or when it goes away, does it usually go away from, maybe this is a question that's hard to answer. Or does it go away out of the DNA sort of altogether? So it would have to sort of spontaneously make a new sort of set of DNA for producing that kind of part.
So that's the $15 million question. I wish I knew the answer. I do not. I do know, I have looked some at the genes that are involved in baleen formation. And surprisingly, some of those genes are actually genes that are involved in tooth making. Mm. So that, when you think, at first you think this doesn't make sense, I must have made a mistake with my experiments. But then as you go further, it does make sense. And I'll tell you why. So humans have two generations of teeth, right? We have milk teeth that are then replaced by permanent teeth. And so this program, this number of genes that you need to build a tooth is switched on, then it stops, and then it's switched on a second time to make the permanent teeth. Modern toothed whales only have one generation of teeth. So they somehow switched off that second generation of teeth altogether. And that's odd. Most mammals have two generations of teeth. You know, if you go back, reptiles will have, you know, 20 or 30 generations of teeth. It keeps on. They get a tooth, like a crocodile. It gets a tooth, and then the tooth falls out. It makes a new one. It makes a new one. Falls out. Makes a new one. Falls out. So mammals can count to two in with their teeth, not more than that. Toothed whales, like dolphins and sperm whales, only count to one. I just told you that the baleen whales actually start making teeth and then don't. So it seems that what they're doing is they're starting to make these teeth that they resorb, and then they switch on that same developmental program of gene expression, and now it makes baleen. So they've actually stuck with that original counting to two to make teeth thing, except for the second time, the same genes that are supposed to make teeth don't make teeth, but they make baleen. So yes, there's some big changes going on. On the other hand, in the overall pattern, wow, that's kind of cool. And so we know very well how nails form. Another structure that's keratin in us is hair. We know very well how hair forms, and there's a specific set of genes that are involved in making those keratinized structures. But that's not what's used for baleen plates. Baleen plates use the tooth genes. Really cool example of having a system and then using it for something else. It's like, I like to think of it as, you know, when you're a carpenter, you use a hammer and a screwdriver to make a chair, but yeah, you could also use it to make a desk. And so we have the tools, these genes, and they can be made they can be used for multiple purposes.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the things that's really interesting for me, just as I try and like think about this and picture it in my head a little bit. You mentioned it at the talk the other evening, you know, it's easy to forget about the constraint that everybody had to survive along the way. And so, you know, getting from here to there means that every generation had to survive and you know, change a little bit, but and of course over millions of years. So each form in between had to be functional in some way. And so sometimes that, you know, it's like getting from your nose, you know, front facing or whatever to on the top of your head and separated from your mouth and all of that stuff. It's interesting to try and consider what might be functional intermediates for some of those. And so I suppose teeth are like, who was the first whale? Like, were they growing them both at the same time for a while? Or,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
so we have some animals. There are some animals nowadays in the Antarctic, actually, like leopard seals and Weddell seals that eat quite a bit of krill. Mm. And they tend to use their teeth. It's not quite clear, but they seem to be using their teeth to filter out, you know, take water in their mouth and use it and filter with their teeth. Their teeth have like little prongs. So that's sort of an interesting step to think about. They're not using their teeth to chew with, but they're using it to filter as if they were baleen plates. So I'm going to try to live for 30 million years and then see if if those seals have changed. But that's an interesting thing to think about. Evolution really is not an engineer. Evolution is more a tinkerer. You know, you have an old car in your garage and somebody who likes cars can fix things on it. But if the car needs to drive anyway, they don't make big changes because right. the next day they won't be able to get to work. But, you know, they might just replace the lights and then the lights don't work very well. And then they replace them with something else. And that's the way evolution works too. Small steps to not create this thing that doesn't work because that'll be at the end of the experiment. So evolution really works as a hobbyist, as a tinkerer with structures, not with organisms, not as an engineer who designs it from scratch.
So, you know, it occurs to me, I guess, you mentioned the seals in the Antarctic and using, like, it looks like, looking like they're using their teeth for filtering. And I guess that the you know, the pinnipeds are a separate move back to the sea. But are they, and I guess I sometimes get stuck in the thought of forgetting that this isn't a finished product that we're looking at. It's like this is continuing on into the future. So as you say, if you live 30 million years, you know, I guess it could be thought that the pinnipeds now are kind of on their way to ever more whale-like forms or something. If a whale form is more optimized than the pinniped form is for living in the sea. Is that, I mean, and I, obviously they can diverge. Some of them could go the whale route. Some of them could stay the pinniped route. Or, you know, what we currently think of as pinnipeds. Likewise, the sea otters that we have here, obviously very, you know, land otters are in the water all the time, but not like sea otters are. So, you know, I guess they seem a little closer to land animals than a lot of the pinnipeds do. But do you get any insight from kind of looking at other groups that are kind of in this progression, but maybe at a different point in the a progression of moving back to the sea, essentially?
Yeah, it's so cool when I started to work that there was all these experiments going on around me with different levels of aquaticness. So, yes, you're right. Pinnipeds, seals, sea lions, and fur seals, and walrus, those are closely related. They had ancestors that had nothing to do with whales. Their closest relative on land is probably bears. Not otters. Otters are yet a different branch. A third group of aquatic mammals is manatees and dugongs and Stellus ceca, which you have here. Their closest land relative is elephants. So at least three different movements into the water, and then, yeah, an otters would be a fourth one. Seals and sea lions, fur seals, walrus are an interesting group because they're actually, their earliest ancestors are 30 million years old. They've had a lot of time to change, so they must be very happy where they are. You might say maybe what they might be doing in the water, that role is already taken by whales, so they don't want to become more aquatic. But they are very functional organisms, and what they do is very... they're very adapted to their environment. I think what's useful about them, one of the things that's useful about them for me is that it sort of teaches me, or it shows me what is a difficult thing to do on land. Like basically those animals do all their feeding in the water. That's not the problem. However, stuff relating to reproduction is difficult. You know, they often have depending on the species, have their pups on land. And the pups stay on land for a long time. Giving birth is difficult. Mating often happens in shallow water because it's hard to hold on to each other when you're... I think that probably was a problem for these early whales too, that some of those functions made that they didn't go into the water right away. Not till they had worked out those problems, they started going into the water permanently and not come back. In a way, it's difficult, right? If you're a seal or a sea lion, you need sense organs that work both in air and water. Whales, you know, if they don't see very well above in the air, who cares? That's not where they make their living. Whales actually see pretty well still in air, but they can be very much more specialist than pinnipeds can. So, it's really neat to have those different experiments going on around me. Before I worked on whales, for a while I worked on bats, a few years. And that was interesting. That's, of course, also an animal that's very differently specialized from most mammals because they fly, and they're very good flyers, and they don't really do very well, you know, on a hard surface. And there the frustration was that there's no intermediate fossils. The earliest bats that we have, which are about the same age as the earliest whales, about 50 million years, the earliest bats look like bats. They have full wings and they could certainly fly. So for whales, we have this whole rich experiment going on right now. For bats, we sort of have that. We have some mammals that are gliders, like flying squirrels. Mm. But that's still a far cry from being an active flight animal. So for whales, we have all these experiments going on of other mammals that have gone aquatic to different degrees. Plus, we have this amazing fossil record that allows us to study them.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about all this. And I guess the other group that's kind of returning to the sea in some forms are birds. And I suppose their physiology is probably significantly different. And of course, some of them, you know, are penguins that are flightless and really adapted. And our local birds here that are diving birds, you know, they can still fly. I don't know, maybe you haven't done any work with birds at all. So, if this is a question that you don't know about, that's fine. But I was just curious if you did know, like, are some of the adaptations for life in the water, like, are there parallel adaptations among the birds as well?
Yeah. So I have not worked much with birds, so apologies to the bird people. But there's definitely some similarities. For instance, some of these early whales had trouble staying underwater because they have these lungs filled with air, and then you sort of float. You can't, if you're wading or bottom walking, which we think they did. So what these early whales are is that they make their bones very heavy. So that is ballast that keeps them on the ground, and so now they can walk at the bottom of these rivers. I was describing earlier these whales that walk in very shallow rivers. Well, they weren't swimming. They were actually wading. That's true for some of the aquatic birds too, that they get these very heavy bones. The coolest similarity between birds, aquatic birds, and whales, baleen whales, is the stuff I've been doing with bowhead whales, which is looking at their sense of smell. Because some birds actually do have a sense of smell. Most birds do not. Some that do is, you know, like the petrel and albatross group. They're called the tube-nosed birds. They will be able to smell krill. So what krill does when it's in the water, there's a chemical that dissolves from krill that actually then will evaporate into the air over a cloud of krill, and then the wind might take that chemical in other places. There's been good experiments with these birds that chemical actually attracts them. It's called dimethyl sulfide, DMS. So those birds have a sense of smell. We actually think that baleen whales also have a sense of smell, and possibly for that same chemical. And an observation that matches that is that people on whale watching boats on the east coast of the U.S. have noticed that on the boat they will smell DMS. DMS smells like boiled cabbage, so they'll get this boiled cabbage smell, and then the animal that they're watching, which is usually right whales, which is a kind of baleen whale very closely related to bowhead whales. The right whale will turn and will swim into the wind as if it too smelt that food for it. My approach has been, as an anatomist, that's basically what I do. And so I've looked at the brain of bowhead whales, and that's very similar to the brain of other baleen whales, like humpbacks or blue whales, minke whales. And those whales, bowhead whales, have a specific part of the brain that you can recognize that's dedicated to smell. So that's how we figured out that bowhead whales must have a sense of smell. Then we also looked at the genes, and the genome of bowhead whales also has a bunch of genes that we know in other animals are related to the sense of smell. So that's pretty well accepted now that they have a sense of smell. Really weird, right? Because this is an animal that lives underwater. Smell only works in air. What's it doing? But I think that I just told you the link, that they actually smell the dimethyl sulfide from the krill.
It just occurred to me, but like, there's so much in the water. Maybe it's obvious how they would... It's not obvious to me, I guess, how they would tell what direction the wind is blowing. Like, I could turn my head or whatever. Are they coming up multiple times, or can they... Oh, they have...
So I don't know what they do, but I have a really cool idea. Bowhead whales and right whales are one of the few species of whale that still have hair. Mm. So bowheads have hair on their chin, like a beard. They have a little bit of hair on the tip of their snout, like a mustache. But then they also have this row of hairs planted right behind the blowhole. And we've measured these, and they're actually different hairs. They're less stiff than the hairs on their chin and on their lip. And as they breathe, those hairs are out of the water. And I think that they act as weather vanes, that the whale will realize that the wind, will determine the wind direction from the wind wiggling its facial hair.
Mm. Well, that makes sense. at the talk, one of the things that was pretty interesting to me was just all the different sensory stuff. You've been talking about smell here, and you mentioned the vision. Whale vision isn't terrible out of the water. I don't know. I guess I've heard of them doing like spy hopping things. Maybe some species only, but like, well, they'll come up and they'll kind of look out of the water. So the sense of smell is the thought is that most whales that's gone. Like that was not useful, and so it just sort of was no longer supported. But there's a few whales that still do have it.
So it's pretty clear that in the dolphin group, which is the whales that are most which are closely related to whales, that it's gone. And that includes killer dolphins, includes killer whales, but also dolphins. Porpoises are also in that group. It must be gone. It's a little less clear what happens in sperm whales. They're sort of hard to study, eh? But as you look at the gene evidence, the toothed whales, which is all of those guys, sperm whales, beaked whales, killer whales, dolphins, porpoises, the genes suggest that those have no smell left. I've not looked at all their brains, so I don't know about the brain stuff. It seems that in the baleen whales, humpback, blue, gray, bowhead, right, that those still have a pretty good sense of smell. It seems that that's the way it breaks down. But I'm not saying that with 100% confidence.
Yeah, and I guess, obviously there's a connection to food. I don't know if there would be, a lot of animals, I think you mentioned this in the talk, actually, that a lot of animals are, for reproduction, mating, like communication between animals in the same species, or probably even different species, if they're out in a forested environment, or an environment where there's multiple species moving around. I don't know how you would start to tell whether that's the case. Whales are a little difficult to study in that way.
The first thing you would do is to see whether the males have different... Well, so if they are communicating with scents, then you would expect there are differences between the sexes, because the first thing you want to do if you want to find a mate is to know whether the animal you're talking to is actually your sex or not. So you would expect the sexes to have different glands that produce these odorants, or different levels of development of the sensory organ that deals with them. That's a good place to start. For now, but as you said, it's hard to determine in animals as big as a bowhead whale. And for now, it seems all the evidence that we have seems to be more consistent with that they're smelling their food and not. The interest in thinking about intraspecific communication, talking to your species mates, is mostly because their land relatives, these even-toed ungulates that I mentioned, whether those are, because in them, certainly chemical communication is actually very important, for instance, for deer. So that's why we think that probably their ancestors had it. but maybe not. I mean, that's 50 million years ago, so you forget some tricks in 50 yeah. million years.
Well, and that actually is something that I was kind of curious about. Obviously, you know, 50 million years, it's easy enough to talk about and write down the numbers and so forth, but it's really kind of an immense span of time in a lot of respects, and hard to really have a solid feel for, I guess, for me. But like, how long does it take for senses or you know, to different adaptations? I guess we talked about the baleen before. Like, you know, what's a typical time for something to develop or disappear, I guess? I mean, yeah. I wouldn't imagine it disappears in a single generation, but maybe things go way faster than they appear, or I don't know. Is there a sense of kind of like how long it takes for
it all change? Depends on how strong the selection pressures are, how bad the animal needs it, or how expensive it is also. If you look at the sense organs in the fossil whales, you know, vision, olfaction, hearing, and balance. Those are four sense organs that I've studied. Balance is the sense organ that changes the quickest. So before whales became aquatic, their organ of balance, which is located in the ear, is already totally modern. All the other organs are way slower. Olfaction, hearing, vision change much after balance. I don't know why that is. It's a very unusual for that organ to change so much. And I don't think it was an adaptation for aquatic life either, because modern seals and manatees and dugongs have actually an organ of balance that looks very much like their land relatives, but not on whales. Whales really change it to be different from their land relatives. I don't know what drove that. That's another real cool question that I would like to look into.
So is it just in the structure, like how it looks? I mean, would there be a suspicion that it functions differently?
Yeah, so the organ I'm talking about is called the semicircular canals, and you have three of them in each ear, and they basically look like tiny little bicycle tubes, bicycle wheels. Bicycle tires is the way to describe them. So there are these cavities in the bone that are the shape of a bicycle tire, circular, and there may be their diameter is that of a dime or a penny or so pretty small. And they're arranged in the three dimensions. They're all at right angles to each other, so that any movement of the head, one or more of those semicircular canals will register it, and that's how you know that you're not falling over. If you're starting to fall over, those organs will register that, and you will, and reflexly, without you realizing it, your muscles will compensate for it. So the diameter of those canals scales with body size very clearly. Elephant has way bigger canals than a mouse, except for whales. And whales, all whales, dolphins, porpoises, and whales, all cetaceans, those semicircular canals are way smaller, to the point where a blue whale, which is way big, obviously, their semicircular canals are about the size of the semicircular canals of a human. So orders of magnitude different, and it's only cetaceans that do that. Manatees, like I said, seals, sea lions, all are with the land mammals, but the cetaceans have really tiny semicircular canals. Given that these are cavities in the bone, we can see them in fossils, so we know exactly when that happened. It happened about 45 million years ago that those organs shrank to a size so tiny, much too tiny for a land mammal. You might think that, well, and I do think that that must have affected their ability to walk on land, because they would have been a lot less stable on their feet. So that's a reason to think that that's when aquatic habits.
That could have been a key in that they didn't stay as tied to the land as other.
Yeah, other interesting animals. That would drive it. I think it's probably the other way around. They were in the water and then got rid of it. But I cannot tell what caused what.
Because you said, so if at 45 million, that was in the time period where they had already started becoming sort of semi-aquatic, shallow water.
Yeah.
Kind of.
So the particular animal that we studied this for, you might compare to a fur seal. Mm. So they did come on land some still, but they're probably just stuff relating to reproduction. And that wouldn't be terrible. If they're just going up, crawling up on the beach, you know, their belly on the ground, it wouldn't be terrible to not have good balance. Modern feral seals have very good balance on land. So that's the difference. And they have big semicircular canals too. It's confounded a little bit with... So the way those semicircular canals work, there's a number of functions, but they're tight by a reflex to both your eyes and your neck. So a cool experiment for you to do if you have a lot of time and you're not too worried about your car is to drive on a bumpy road pretty fast and then have not the driver but the person next to the driver put their cell phone on the dashboard and record and make a movie. And then watch the movie right after you took that drive. And the movie will look way more bumpy than you perceived it. Because what you don't realize is that as you're driving on that road, your eyes are moving up and down very fast to compensate for the bumps in the road. And so the way that works is that the semicircular canals realize that your body is bumping, and as your body is bumping up, there's a reflex from the semicircular canals to the eye muscles that move the eyes down to compensate. It's not perfect, but it'll be way better. The road will look way bumpier on your phone if you have it in contact with the dashboard because it doesn't have that mechanism. So the way that compensation works is that partly through the eye muscles, also through the neck muscles. Your whole head will be compensating for the movements of the shaking movements of your body to compensate for that. These early whales had very short necks and not much mobility, so it's possible that that's a reason why the organ of balance was getting smaller, because it couldn't compensate for that. But I'm really torn about, you know, what came first, what's the causal relation. I noticed there's a correlation between these two things, but I don't know what caused it. Which is the cause for which, if the going into the water and no neck mobility came first to make the semicircular canals smaller, or whether the canals went smaller and that made them. So that's harder to figure out.
Yeah. I imagine you'd need a fair amount of fossil density in that time period.
Yes. And like I said, these whales are also all really different. So there's whales at that point that look like otters and like seals and like crocodiles. It's not like one design. There was really this phase of experimentation with body shapes that, and so they all might have different requirements for sense organs that match that particular body shape and not the other. So it's not a clean story with one direction.
Did they all have the smaller, proportionally smaller balance organs?
For the ones that we have, well, the earliest whales at 50 million, no, they're like land mammals. And then suddenly at about 45, they have the small canals. But we don't have the right bones for all of those animals, so we don't know.
Not sure. Yeah, I noticed that for my own balance, and I guess maybe there's a feedback loop or something in the brain. Like if I close my eyes, my balance is worse.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And
yeah.
So I guess maybe it's kind of I definitely noticed that if. And I guess that's why it feels like you're going to get motion sick more when you watch a video that's bumpy. It's because you can't, like,
because
your eyes are wanting to compensate for it, but there's no.
That's correct. Sort of your body's actually things. Not moving, yeah. But your eyes are telling your brain that you are moving, not the screen. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of interesting how that works, and I can see that. Yeah, once that goes away, you'd have trouble on land, where that's not as critical in the water. I don't know how, I mean, proprioception, our sense of where we are in the water, it seems, or where we are in space, I guess I should say. I'm not sure how that is actually sensed exactly. Maybe it's some sort of a mental model of our bodies that coordinates with the whole, you know, movement and nervous system stuff.
So, yeah, your brain gets information both from the semicircular canals, but also from the eye about what your mm-hmm. position is. So there's been this really cool experiment that this physician did. He who studies, you know, who works on people who have balance problems. So he tied a gyroscope to the head of a rodeo bull and to a dolphin in a SeaWorld type place. And then he measured in the movement regime that those two animals have, how much their head shook. And the rodeo bull was way worse because in water, the water dampens all the movements that you make. So his point was, well, balance is less important for animals underwater because they already have the vibration controlled by all this water. Well, maybe that's true. And then I haven't talked to him about it, but he would probably say that manatees move so slow that for them it's not a problem at all. So that's another... So basically that's a story that's definitely not finished. It's one of these areas where we really... We don't know the pattern. We don't know for every ancient whale what the semicircular canals are. But we also don't understand enough of how these things evolve and what came first. So we really need to, if we want to figure this out, it'll take a lot more time to do that.
Well, and so another question, and maybe this is out because it's not really a specific sense organ per se, I guess, is the whole sense of like how you are in space with bodies. And it's easy to imagine like a large whale being sort of lumbering and not capable of much finesse, I guess, or maneuvering. But my sense is that whales actually are pretty aware of where they are and in space, despite having a huge body. Is that anything that you've looked at all?
Yeah, I would certainly say that a bunch of humpback whales that do bubble net feeding and that have to sort of orient their body in a way that's consistent with the seven animals around them, or a killer whale chasing a seal, accurate positioning and response, quick responding to changes in position or water currents or pushing them is actually very important. So yes, on that one, I don't think they have less of a need for precise coordination. But that's not what you asked, and I now forget what you asked.
Oh, I was just curious if there's, partly because I don't know how it's oriented in humans, but or other animals, but I've heard of it as proprioception, or like a dancer is much more graceful and just has a very strong awareness of body and place and movement, whereas as somebody without that training would have less of that, but still be able to avoid bumping into things without ever really thinking about it. They just know where their body is.
That's true. That's for the dancer. That's training. There's some natural ability there too. You can't make your semicircular canals bigger or smaller during your life. They're there forever. The ballet dancer that's a development thing. You can train your muscles to respond faster and to respond more appropriate to the fall. To not over respond and then make you fall the other way. So that's a bunch of that. Some of that is inborn, but. But some of that is also just training.
So, one thing that I know that there are fish that, for example, as I understand it, sense electrical currents and stuff in the water that, and I don't know if, I don't even know how you'd begin to look for sort of senses that are useful in water that might not be useful on land in the same way. And 50 million years is a long time, I guess, for those things to potentially develop, it seems like. Is there any sense of whether there have been sort of senses that weren't useful on land that have developed, either from some sort of thing that got turned on that used to be there but it wasn't anymore on land animals, or just developed because there was a mutation and that was adaptive, and so then it went from there?
I suppose my favorite one that my lab is now really working on is magnetoreception. Which is a sense that some mammals have, land mammals have, but we think whales have it too. And because I'm interested in, I'm really an anatomist by training, we studied the eye of bowhead whales. And in the eye, there are some surprising things. And one of them is that some of the proteins that are involved in magnetoreception in birds, where we know that those proteins are there because birds can detect the magnetic field, and it's those proteins that do it. Those proteins are also there in the eyes of bowhead whales. So it's possible that they're there for magnetoreception. It's also possible that those proteins have some other function that I don't know when they're not involved with magnetoreception. But There are some indications that whales can sense a magnetic field. For instance, at times when there are sunspots, when a magnetic field goes a little bit off kilter for a little bit, on those times there is more strandings of whales on the beach, maybe because their system of orientation is messed up. Google Maps didn't work for them. There's also evidence of whales that migrate for long distances through open ocean with no landmarks, seem to follow magnetic lines. We noticed it. So we tried to test the idea that boats have this. When boat whales in spring migrate from the Bering Sea to the Beaufort Sea, they swim north and then they hit Point Barrow, and then they swim due east into Canadian waters. And that is an area that's very deep, so they can't see the bottom. And it's featureless, far from shore. And they swim due east. How can they do that if they don't have a compass? So we actually think that they have a compass in their heads. We actually have devices on some of these whales that tell us where they are. And we try to, this is work mostly done by people at the North Slope Borough in collaboration with people at Alaska Fish and Game. So we try to see whether those lines that those boats swim from Point Barrow straight east into Canadian waters, whether those deviate when the magnetic field goes haywire for a little bit. And our resolution wasn't good enough to show that, because the magnetic field goes off for, like half an hour. But our data points were 6 hours apart, so by then the whale will long have recovered. So we actually couldn't show that. But that's a really interesting idea. So we have some anatomical evidence. Behavior in some other whale species suggests it's consistent with a sense of the magnetic field. That would actually be very important for them to be able to have it would be very good for them if they had a compass somewhere in their body. And so I think it's in their eyes. Other people think it's in their brain. The real answer is we don't know where it is at this point yet, but that's another thing we're working on.
Yeah. So, I've seen in the news sometime in the last few months that the magnetic North Pole is moving.
Yeah.
And I guess so they must have some ways of compensating because presumably they're moving relative to that, but they can adjust somehow, over time that they also have a map of some sort that they're sort of mental map, so to speak, of the territory, so to speak, that they can calibrate with or use to recalibrate, I suppose, perhaps. Because it seems like over time, like if it's moving, especially in the north, where relatively speaking, that can be pretty significant compared to, say, the equator.
Yeah, I think that, if you're trying to end up in Sitka Harbor, you need exact coordinate. Mm. If you just want to feed on aggregations of krill in the southeast, if you're off by 50 miles, it's not that big a deal. And I think the latter is what the boats worry about. So I think that level of resolution, the changing of the pole, I don't think they realize that the pole is moving. I don't think they compensate for it. They just end up in the wrong place and then they have to swim north. But it's also, they don't really care as long as there's food there. And then once they get closer to the feeding fields, they will have other clues why, there's nothing here. Maybe I should, I'll swim this way or that way. So I think it's not just magnetoreception.
Right. No, that makes sense. And I mean, it's sort of, as my understanding is over, certainly over the millions of years time scale we're talking about, I think, I can't remember if it's even more like hundreds of thousands of years, but the poles switch.
It does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess that would mess things up for a little bit, potentially. Or they just couldn't rely on it for that until they recalibrated it at some level. But maybe that, I don't know, and maybe it's not known how fast that switch actually happens, whether it happens pretty quickly or...
Yeah, the switch happens very fast. Well, very fast. And then it's maybe like 2 or 3 million years in the same position, then it flips again. So we know some about this from birds. Area in India where I worked, there's a lot of flamingos that in winter spent their winters there raising their young, but in summers they fly south to Africa to feed. And interestingly, some of those animals get their compass turned around and they fly north into Siberia. So there's this zoo in Siberia that has a lot of flamingos that have their compass messed up. Because, of course, they come exhausted. It is very cold and there's nothing to eat. So people catch them and give them to the zoo. So that happens. It shows that they still have a compass in their head, except it's rotated 180 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what I've heard, that vagrant birds are most often, they go 180 degrees off. Off their target line. And sometimes, I think the next most often was maybe 90 degrees off or something like that. But I don't know I know you had a picture that showed sort of what it's thought that pigeons, I think it was pigeons in Europe that they had studied, might be seen depending on which direction they're looking.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating to me to think about being able to, I mean, they wouldn't need to have their eyes open, presumably, to be sensing direction at that point. So it's kind of interesting to think about that. But yeah, it's been fascinating to hear about the different senses and this sort of this picture of whale evolution over 50 million years. And as we were kind of winding down here, I wondered if there was anything else that you just wanted to mention before we wrap up.
I don't know. I think my interest in evolution that started in Pakistan and India and eventually took me to Alaska's North Slope because I wanted to study more about the stuff that doesn't fossilize, all the soft tissues in an animal, which is very possible there. Now, my interest there has sort of switched because of the amazing changes that we're seeing on the North Slope with global warming, where the ice is retreating at a pace much faster than anybody would have guessed, a decade ago or so. It's going to be terrible for all the Arctic species. So that's what's cool about it for me is that even though I went there to study evolution, I'm now involved in all these projects that actually hopefully will document what will go wrong and hopefully that some of the data from that or the results from that can be used to mitigate some of the worst excesses, but I hope we can do it fast because we're messing up the planet for our kids and our grandkids.
Yeah. And is there a place that folks can go if they want to learn more about the work that you're doing?
So I think the North Slope Borough has a good website that shows the research that they are involved with. And I study beluga whales and bowhead whales, but they study, geese and caribou and all kinds of other stuff. That's a good place to start for the studies there. I wrote a popular book on whale evolution, my work in Pakistan and India. Those are good places to start, I think.
Yeah. All right. What's the name of your book?
The Walking Whales.
The Walking Whales. All right. Great. Well, thanks for coming in and visiting. I hope the rest of your time in Sitka goes well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded and originally aired back in early 2019. I was speaking with Hans Tevesen, who is in town as part of the Science and Research Fellowship at the Sitka Sound Science Center. I want to thank him for taking some time to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here this week on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.